From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. There are many difficult places to live in the world. Undoubtedly, one of the toughest is the Central African Republic. Long week, its central government effectively collapsed in 2014 after an all-out civil war between Muslim militias known as the Seleka and an alliance of mostly Christian groups called the Anti-Balaka. A total of 14 different armed groups now control various parts of the Texas-sized country. President Faustin Archange Touadéra's central government controls little outside the capital, Bangui. Fighting between the various groups over control of the country's rich reserves of diamonds and other natural resources is a regular feature of life. Ordinary citizens in CAR, as it's known, have suffered the most. About a quarter of its 4.5 million people have been forced from their homes. The United Nations Human Development Index, which measures 188 countries around the globe on factors like health, education, and income, ranks CAR dead last. So on this edition of Global Journalist, a look at the crisis in the Central African Republic. In a few minutes, we're going to hear about how the international community has tried to stem the violence there by regulating the sale of diamonds that helps fuel it. We'll also hear about Russia's unusual role in the CAR and the recent mystery surrounding the killing of three Russian investigative journalists there. But first, we're going to bring in Katarina Wilson. She researches the Central African Republic and is a PhD student at the University of Leiden. She joins us from the city of Utrecht in the Netherlands. Katarina, welcome.
Thank you very much. Hello.
Well, give us just a brief overview of the current situation in the Central African Republic right now.
So there was a coup d'etat in 2013 that actually changed a lot of things. It brought the Seleka to the city, to the capital. More or less a year after that, there was the fighting that started between the two groups that you mentioned before, the Seleka and the Balaka groups. And since, the situation has been very difficult and very tense, the day-to-day situation, I mean, for people.
And I'm sorry, we should actually mention there was a French intervention force that eventually helped evict the Seleka, correct?
No, they didn't evict the Seleka. There was a French intervention, yes, and they left already. There was roughly an intervention for 2 years. And curiously, when the French intervention was coming in December 2013, this was the Black December kind of thing. So it's the fighting intensified at the same time it was coming. So the role has always been felt as a very double role, not to say that they have been helping the rebel groups, but by disarming just one side of the rebel groups, they have created an imbalance. And many people in the Central African Republic were not precisely happy with the intervention.
And there has also been this United Nations mission called MINUSCO. What has been their role in this conflict?
Yeah, so the MINUSCO, they replaced the African forces who were there first. The Central African Army, they have had an embargo until the beginning of this year. So they are actually a force that people cannot really count on. They can't. So the role of the UN force has been peacekeeping and more than that. But it has also been criticized a lot because the fighting is still going on. It has not stopped. And there has also been a couple of scandals related with the raping of young children. So the role is also double. The population feels, it's double. On the one side, they feel it brings protection, especially outside of the capital. But on the other side, they are not protected either. So it's not straightforward.
Well, you've been to the Central African Republic a number of times over the last 5 years. I think you were there just a few months ago. Can you just tell us the story of one or two people that illustrates some of the challenges people are facing now?
Yeah. So I first visited the Central African Republic in 2013, right after the coup d'état had taken place. In a very tense period, but at the time you could still travel around the city. You could still go to the big market, the 5 Kilo market, which is now the epicenter of all troubles. And with the years, I've been back a couple of times, and you can see how the city changes, how people are become more and more afraid of going out, especially at night, how they are more careful to tell other people who they are, where they come from, who their family members are. But at the same time, life goes on. So I have seen one of my good friends, for instance, having a burnout, and also due to the situation, because he has not been able to handle it. But at the other side, I have also witnessed a grassroots initiative, like, for instance, a young group of capoeira youngsters who do this martial art and want to help children who are in the streets. So there are both things. There are people trying to make something out of it, and there are people on whose shoulders the situation is so difficult that they actually crumble.
Well,
so.
We mentioned earlier in the program that a good share of the fighting there has been between militias who were once the Seleka coalition, mostly Muslim, and armed groups from the mainly Christian anti-Balaka forces. There are reports of some Islamic fundamentalist fighters that are involved there. On the internet, you can find a lot of Christian groups, especially American Christian groups, raising money to support persecuted Christians in the Central African Republic. I mean, is this a religious war? Is this a religious conflict that's taking place?
No, I would certainly not frame it as a religious conflict, at least not at the beginning. It is a conflict about power and power sharing and who has access to the mineral resources, but also to the state resources. A couple of decades ago, you had a very similar conflict in the Central African Republic, and it was between two different ethnic groups. So at that time, the ethnicity card was being played, and at this time, the religious card is being played. Now, because the fighting has been going on already for quite some years, I mean, we're 2018 now, we're talking about 5 years, things happen, people are being killed from one side, at the one side and also at the other side, and then it becomes more emotional, people want to take revenge, and little by little the discord starts changing among the population. And I think this is one of the most maybe scaring things, that what was not a religious war, I'm not saying that it is now a religious war, but the discord is changing, and it might be becoming little by little something religious, which it was not. I mean, there are many mixed couples in the capital, many Muslims who have married with Christians, and this mix is being threatened.
And unlike some other countries in the region, there isn't a long history of religious violence in the Central African Republic. That's correct, yeah.
No, there has been a long history, especially in pre-colonial times with slave raids, both from the West, the Atlantic slave raids, but also from the eastern coast of Africa and North Sudan slave raids. So there has been a long history of religious conflict. But the problem today is political. It's about power sharing. It's being translated into religion.
Well, I'm glad you raised that, because I want to ask about the role of the president, Faustin Archange Touadéra. He was elected in 2016 after the Seleka had been chased out of the capital, Bangui. How effective has he been in trying to exert control and bring stability?
Well, at the beginning, people were very enthusiastic about having elections and about having an elected president. You must take into account that in the history of the Central African Republic, there has been numerous coup d'etats. So having an election is a positive thing. But now it's been 2 years after he has been elected, and people realize that he can barely control Bangui. I mean, not even his own capital.
So his authority just, you know, extends to the capital city then. Well, let me ask you, because our time grows short, I wanted to ask about the role of humanitarian aid. You know, we talked about something like more than half of the country is dependent on humanitarian aid. How challenging is it for aid groups to get the food and other supplies where it's needed?
Well, the Central African Republic is one of the most forgotten areas within Africa. So the infrastructure is not great. The country, I mean, I only know the capital. I've been in the Central African Republic since the conflict started, so I wasn't able to travel along. But I've seen the presence of the humanitarians grow and grow and grow. And I know that they are not only present in the capital, but that they also go mainly in caravans to other places in the country. So yeah, I think there is a logistic problem, because of the where the central
And there have been
African
a number
Republic
of attacks on aid workers over the past year, I think, as well.
Yes, but this is a bit this duality, I mean, that is expressed towards the, for instance, the UN troops or the French troops. I mean, it is extended to the humanitarians as well.
We're just running out of time, so I'm going to have to stop you there. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
It's a pleasure.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the crisis in the Central African Republic. CAR may be one of the poorest countries in the world, but it has rich reserves of minerals, especially diamonds. However, control over the diamond trade has been a major factor fueling the conflict in the country. So to learn more about the international efforts to stop that, we're joined by Elise Rousseau. She researches the diamond trade from Belgium, which of course is the international capital of diamond trading. She's also completing her PhD at the University of Namur in Belgium. Elise, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Well, start, if you would, just tell us briefly, how is it that diamonds are mined in a place like the Central African Republic?
There are two kinds of diamond deposits in the world. So one kind is the alluvial deposits, which are also called secondary deposits. And the other kind is the kimberlite deposits. In Central Africa Republic, the diamonds are mainly alluvial. And this means that they may be found in the area next to some rivers, and the mining there is mainly artisanal.
So people can dig for them just with shovels and picks and spades then?
Exactly, or diving in the river to try to find them in the bottom of the rivers.
So it's a low technology process then to obtain the diamonds?
Exactly.
Well,
yes.
I mean, it does have significant mineral wealth. I think the reserves there are something like 39 million carats of diamonds. How do they play a role in the conflict?
Since the beginning, the rebel groups have tried to control those areas where they could find diamonds. So the main areas in Central Africa where you can find diamonds is in the prefecture of Mambéré-Kadé in the west, and in the east, in the Haute-Koto prefecture, and then also in the Basse-Koto prefecture. So, and for the moment, the diamond areas in the east are controlled by the ex-Seleka, and in the west by the anti-Balaka movement and the governments. And they play a role because rebels could sell these diamonds and or exchanging them for weapons, and this contributed to fuel the conflict.
So these are basically conflict diamonds then, which is something that, you know, of course, fueled the wars in West Africa, in Sierra Leone, in Liberia for many years in the 1990s. And I understand that there was this international process set up to try to stop that. Talk to us just about how that has played out in the Central African Republic.
The Kimberley process is this tripartite international forum that was created to regulate the rough diamond trade at the international level after the conflict you mentioned. Just so you know, the rough diamonds are the diamonds that are not cut and polished. So it's the stone as you can find them in the river, for example. So the KP, the Kimberley process, control the trade of the diamond. And how does it work? They do it by asking the member to issue some certificates that will accompany the diamond parcels that will be exported from one country to another. That's basically how it works. And there are peer review missions that are organized to...
So that way a buyer will know when they get a diamond, they'll know this diamond came from this place, South Africa or the Central African Republic, and we know it's not a conflict zone. That's how it's supposed to work. But actually, Central African Republic, during the height of the civil war, there was a ban on the sale of diamonds there.
Exactly. In 2013, in May, the Kimberley process suspended temporarily the membership of the Central African Republic. So that means that there was an embargo on all the diamond exports. But this embargo was partially lifted in 2015 for a few compliant zones, which are mainly located in the west of the country.
So and this is the area controlled by the government and the anti-Balaka militias then?
Yeah, by the government. And the review mission was organized by the KP to check if these areas were effectively controlled by the government before they allowed the exportations.
And so I mean, I guess I would question as to whether or not this process, does it actually stop the flow of diamonds? Obviously, the civil war is still ongoing. I mean, how are diamonds still smuggled from the Central African Republic? And if so, how?
Yes, there were some reports from an NGO that mentioned the fact that they were smuggled through Cameroon. That's one of the main smuggling routes for them. Then there are also some smuggling with Chad. Chad, which is not a member of the KP, but Cameroon is a member of the KP. But there is also a risk now that there are some compliance zones that diamond mines in conflict areas are actually smuggled to the compliance zone within the country and then export abroad. So that's a risk that is still possible. Another problem with that is that during the embargo between 2013 and now and 2015, a lot of diamond traders might have stockpiled some diamonds and just wait for the embargo to be lifted. And that's a current problem that the Kimberley process is facing, because they have to make sure that the diamonds that are now entering the global market were not bought during the time of the conflict, during the heat of the conflict. And that's not an easy thing to do.
Well, and I imagine that diamonds are also, I mean, they're the country's biggest export. They're extremely easy to smuggle. I mean, you could carry tens of thousands of dollars worth in a backpack, or, you know, much more than that if you drove a car from one part of the country to the other. And it seems like you mentioned this NGO, I think it's called Global Witness, that researched this. They mm-hmm. said they were basically able to locate diamond smugglers just on social media by looking at people's Facebook pages and WhatsApp. So how effective is the effort to halt conflict diamonds there?
It has been partially effective. I think the KP is doing a good job in trying to provide technical assistance to CAR and to help the government to implement the KP. But of course, diamonds are so small and so easy to smuggle from one country to another that it's always really difficult to control the trade when it comes to diamonds. It doesn't mean that there is nothing positive, but there is still a lot of things to be done.
Well, Elise Roussos, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about the crisis in the Central African Republic, where fighting between more than a dozen armed groups has forced a quarter of the country's 4.5 million people to flee their homes. Now, one new twist in the story of the Central African Republic is the involvement of Russia, which signed an agreement last month to help arm and equip the central government's army. Now, that deal came just weeks after three investigative journalists from Russia were killed in the country in circumstances that are still murky. Now, to tell us more about that, we're joined by Kirill Avramov. He's a research fellow at the University of Texas's Intelligence Studies Project, where, among other things, he tracks Russia's overseas engagements. Kirill, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on the program.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure to have you. Russia had a lot of influence in Africa for years after the end of the Cold War. That ended to some degree after the fall of the Berlin Wall. But now we see Russia present in a number of countries again. Talk to us just a little bit about the Central African Republic. How did that relationship start?
Well, you're absolutely right that we have to talk a little bit about context and of post-Soviet Russia, which is having a resurgent foreign policy and is trying to throw its weight in the different former spheres of influence. In particular, in Central African Republic, obviously, an unstable regime is seeking a help in form of arms sales, which is also fits into the pattern of Mr. Putin's regime to extend influence, but also training of its security forces in order to secure control over the territory of the country. What is interesting is that we looked at this engagement into a wider pattern due to the fact that this wider pattern is present for those regimes which are under pressure, such as Assad's in Syria. So Russia is trying to insert its presence, sort of speak, under the radar and help with countries which experience difficulties and offers them something what we think as a package deal.
So it's sort of it sounds like sort of an opportunistic engagement.
Absolutely. Then. Absolutely. It is a foreign policy adventurism in a, of a sort, because it, from a Russian perspective, is a relatively low-risk, low-cost engagement into areas which allow them to compete directly with former colonial powers such as France, also to offset China's presence, to come to balance Turkey's efforts in the region. So it is really an effort to kill multiple birds with one stone.
Well, before we get to that overall strategy, I want to ask you about this incident where these three Russian investigative journalists were found shot to death, kind of in a remote part of the Central African Republic. Their names are Orkan Jamal, Alexander Rastorgiev, and the photographer Kirill Radchenko. Who were they working for? What were they doing there?
This is the case of very unfortunate tragedy with very well-known journalists, especially Orkan is very well-known investigative journalist in Russia. They were working on an investigation which is backed by one of Mr. Khodorkovsky's center, one of the fiercest critics of Mr. Putin and his regime. They were investigating the multiple reporting from on the ground about the presence of civilian instructors slash possibly cleverly disguised as private mercenary company personnel. And they were on the trip to discover those reports from the ground as a first, what was the nature of the activities of this personnel beyond the officially declared from the Russian government training of the army, due to the fact that the reporting about the people on the ground were actually close to the strategic areas of mining prospecting that were discussed previously on the program. So the situation is quite murky in a sense that it might be rendered as a cold case and simply dismissed as an armed robbery.
I mean, what did the Central African Republic, Russia, what did they say about their deaths?
In the initial, the initial version of the official version of the Central African Republic's investigation is that it was a armed robbery, and it was executed by initially one of the versions was talking about turban man that did not speak any of the local languages. But more or less, they gravitate towards the idea of those people being robbed for the money they were carrying and for the cameras and so on. Of course, there is always a lingering suspicion what really was the motif, and there's a lot of speculation about out there.
What is their organization, this investigative news outlet run by an opponent of President Putin, we should say. What is their organization said about their deaths?
Well, they are still. They actually have sent personnel also on the ground to, along with the officially sent representatives of the Russian government and the Russian embassy. They want to know and to clear out all the details, of course, because they consider that there might be a different motive for the killing of those journalists, in a sense that they might have discovered a trail which leads and links the activities of those private mercenary companies to the prospecting that was discussed previously.
Sorry, if I could, you mentioned the private mercenary companies. If I understand correctly, one of the companies working in the Central African Republic is this organization called Wagner. What do we know about Wagner? It has been in the news some recently.
Yes, Wagner is a nickname for what appears to be a private mercenary company and security company, and it became infamous more or less for its involvement in different theaters rather than Central African Republic. So this is just the last instance into appearance of their personnel, or allegedly their personnel, has been reported. It is a company which has been engaged in its personnel in eastern Ukraine, but the incident that they became infamous for is actually the one in Syria near Deir ez-Zor, where they, without consulting the regular Russian army on the ground, decided to attempt to capture a gas and oil, a gas field, and they had a direct confrontation with the U.S. forces. Of course, that led to a number of casualties, which initially were denied, and we should understand why the denial is there, due to the fact that the Russian state prohibits mercenary activities. So, in effect, those are semi-stealth companies and disguised as security companies, which are contracted to guard strategic assets on the ground. However, what we see in the Central African Republic is very, very similar to a model that we see developing in all those countries that I was talking about, where Russia is trying to throw its weight under the radar. Basically, it seems that after this political blessing is secured at the level of presidents or prime ministers, the local government contracts those security companies, but usually gives them a chance to what we call to execute raid, seize, and exploit strategy, which entails the possibility for the company to capture strategic sites which are not under the control of the central government of the host country.
And then exploit the resources there. So in this case, the resource would be diamond mines, and we think that this may be...
And gold.
Diamond and gold, and we think that this may be what these investigative journalists were on the trail of when they were killed, was that they were looking into whether or not this company, Wagner, had been operating diamond mines with Russian mercenaries then.
Correct. We are sure that actually their task was exactly that. They went actually to look on the spot and to see what was the composition of the Russian presence on the ground in Central African Republic. We do have 170 people officially declared, out of which 5 are military personnel and the rest are civilian instructors. Now, interestingly enough, even a simple OSINT search will show you that there was multiple reporting of those civilian personnel or civilian contractors which were present in different areas of the country, not necessarily controlled by the government, but also in territories of ex-Seleka. And that would raise questions, do their efforts connected to probably scouting, prospecting, and also looking forward to execute additional activities beyond simple military training. To our understanding, that would fit again the model that we're looking at, which is developing not only in Central African Republic, but also in Sudan, and it's connected to prospecting in Zimbabwe, in Rwanda, but also in the incident that I mentioned in Syria, due to the fact that you have to understand that those companies are usually backed, and in this case, the so-called Putin chef stands behind Wagner, no one else. Those are people that win enormous procurements from the Russian government, and they're well connected with the state apparatus.
So they're basically operating. I'm sorry, we're just out of time, but it sounds like they're basically operating semi-officially with the blessing of the Russian government. But I apologize. We're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Katerina Wilson, Elise Rousseau, and Kirill Avramov. Our assistant producers this week are Chris Kroonen, Tatum Pugh, and Melody Zhao. Yanqi Shu is our supervising producer, and Maggie Duncan is visual editor. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.